Welcome to another episode of Lapide CISA Talks. Today I'm joined by Dane Clagworthy, Head of Sales at Cyber Prism and a Royal Marines veteran. Dane, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you so much, Vitaly. Nice to be on here.
Yeah, I remember when we did our sort of previous meeting setup call for this, I immediately picked up on a South African accent.
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, long story short, I'm originally from Cape Town, and I moved over when I was about 18, 19, did the 2 year working thing in London, living the dream, living in a Dosser's house, and doing some traveling. But yeah, I've been here ever since, really. And I'm sure we'll get into it, but coming over to join the military was a big step in staying here, and that's progressed, you know, until now, where, you know, I'm sort of working for a company in cybersecurity. So, yeah, quite a interesting journey, and one that, you know, I'm quite proud of.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot to unpack there. And I won't belabor the SAFA point too much, but yeah, beautiful country. My wife's South African, so we were there in January, actually, traveling the garden route and visiting Cape Town, drinking all the nice wine. Yeah. So, yeah, I'm you know, I'm surprised you left, but I suppose, you know, opportunities and you know, going to. So how did you land on Royal Marines, and where were you based?
Yeah, sure. So, interesting sort of story, slightly amusing story, where, yeah, sort of go back to when I was a young lad, and my dad was a shipwreck diver, quite a successful shipwreck diver, found, you know, quite a few ships all around the world. And my childhood was, you know, going along with him, you know, bringing up this treasure and then sort of divvying out this treasure amongst all the divers. And it could be cannons, it could be silver ingots, gold coins, muskets, you name it. It was all recovered. But in my dad's office, there were two paintings, two really old paintings. And one of them was the Birkenhead. It's an old ship, and then the Joanna, another old ship. Which the painting itself was like a scene of utter devastation. You know, there were two ships there. You might have heard of the Birkenhead drill. It's a famous drill where sort of the captain calls out, you know, women and children first. And yes. There's a scene where,
like, they've the Titanic.
Got these, yeah, they've got these military soldiers all in formation, you know, and they're in rank, and the ship is breaking up around them, and of course these women, mothers, children are sort of clambering over into the lifeboats, and of course there weren't enough lifeboats, and so, you know, these soldiers went down with the ship, and you know, that as a young lad really sort of impressed upon me. And then the next painting was this Joanna ship, and again another scene of devastation and utter chaos, and the ship had broken up, and in the water on this painting, this oil painting, were these people, like, sort of clinging to life. You know, they were sort of, you know, holding on to some sort of like piece of wood. There are people trying to swim over. There's other people trying to help them. And as a young lad, this sort of, like, you know, it sort of captured my imagination in terms of leadership and management. So fast forward so many years, I always had this need, this want to sort of be a good leader, sort of to test my leadership in the most sort of, you know, trying of circumstances. And I had this vision of, you know, joining the military. And I first looked at joining the South African Navy. Now, sort of an amusing story. I went to the open day. So I didn't quite join, but I went to the open day, and it was packed, absolutely packed, a huge room. And this guy comes in, sort of naval officer with his pristine white uniform, and he stood up on the stage and he said, "This is a fantastic turnout." He said, "Out of interest, how many of you can actually swim, are competent swimmers?" And I think there must be about four of us that put our hands up amongst, yep, like these hundreds of people. So I turned to the guy next to me and I said, "Hey, listen, we're in for a good chance here. I think we're going to make it." But funny old thing, I wasn't accepted. There was lots of change in South Africa with the change of governments. You know, all good change, and that sort of kiboshed my naval career in South Africa. And then I sort of came over to the UK and then found out about the Royal Marines. Did my research, went to the library, and I thought, absolutely, this is the sort of fighting force that I wanted to join, sort of develop my leadership and management in the most sort of trying of circumstances, but also in some of the most exciting challenges, which, you know, it lived up to the hype, should I say.
Did you train at the one near where I lived, Lymston?
Yes,
Royal Marines, the principal base.
Yeah, Commando Training Center, Royal Marines. That's just near Exeter, for those that don't know. And getting there is quite the journey. They've got a little train stop in between Exeter and Exmouth. These young recruits turn up from all parts of the UK, all parts of the world, actually. They bring a little briefcase, and then they, get off the train, and then this sergeant, quite a serious looking a military person opens the gate, and then you get ushered in, and then you're in their clutches. The training is some of the toughest training in the world. 32 weeks of arduous training. For me, you watch TV and you see a lot of American type films, and I had the stereotypical viewpoint that if you join the military, you want to be big and strong, and you want to be pumping weights and getting massive. And that's exactly what I did before I joined the Marines. Until I realized that it wasn't about that. It was all about endurance.
Stamina,
grit. Yomping, with massive Bergens on, road climbing, working on the bottom field. And all that sort of muscle that I built up sort of.
You can't do a single pull-up. Yeah, it's weighing you down.
I could do the pull-ups, I could do the rope climbs and the endurance courses. So I changed immensely, but it was the mindset that changed. That's really the most interesting part from your journey from civilian to Royal Marine. It's that belief, that mindset that you change. Everyone struggles at something in Royal Marines training. You know, there were guys that were fitter than me, more capable than me, on the bottom field. They could do more press-ups, more pull-ups. But for whatever reason, the negativity got into their heads, and they sort of decided that maybe they weren't quite good enough. And then, you try and overcome those challenges, that sort of mental negativity that you sort of bring up in yourself, and you work your way through the training. But what you get at the end of it is a real sort of, I think, sort of resilience and mental robustness. And that's exactly why I joined, to develop that. And so that's helped me, today where I am now.
Fantastic. Well, it's definitely sounded like a truly lifelong formative experience, and sort of kind of moving on to, all the toughness and the training aside, the grueling experiences. Where did you go from there? Where did that career take you? And sort of how did then that progress to a role or a career in the cybersecurity space?
Young Marine, straight out from training, I became a communicator, signaler. So you're working with radio networks, data comms, and crypto. So, there was a thing called BACO, battle code, which you'd, sort of encrypt this message and then send it over the insecure networks, and someone would have to decipher it. Really long-winded process. But worked my way up through the sort of communication specialization as a signaler. I was I say this with inverted commas, I was fortunate enough to go to Optelec, which is Iraq, 2003, as a signaler. And that was quite the experience. And again, from a sort of leadership position, looking into the leaders, there were some really powerful leaders, which, you know, I learned a lot from. But that was an experience, sort of fast forward, and I sort of climb my way up through the ranks, and then became a Yeoman of Signals. And for those that don't know, that sort of Yeoman of Signals is like a communications manager, but more of a specialist. And so you have Yeoman of Signals, and then you also have a Foreman of Signals. Okay. And the Foreman of Signals is a very technical specialization, whereby the Yeoman of Signals for me is, it's got the technical bit, but you come from it at a point where you can articulate what the requirement is. So what the need is, and you can reason, you can explain to the people that that need, you know, that requirement. But you can also then speak to the technical guys and have that conversation too, and you can sort of match both of them up together. So, you know, the technical guys, that information, and then you can articulate it to the people that are using it on the ground. And I think that was my biggest strength, is communicating what was required. And that applies to my position today as head of sales for Cyber Prism. You know, I have to speak to the tech team. I have to understand what they're saying, but I need to put it in such a way that the end user, you know, the client, can understand it. And that sort of helped me out massively. But Yeoman of Signals, and then I got commissioned as an officer, and I was a radio signals officer, you know, working with the Navy and working on projects like, you know, the Queen Elizabeth class carrier, setting up their CIS aviation infra plan before the ship was commissioned. And that was interesting. That was looking at, you know, sort of capability, systems, bringing in the different military arms, you know, the different cap badges, whether that was Army Air Corps, RAF, the Royal Air Squadrons, and bringing them, and then understanding what the requirement was, and then making that happen, putting that in place. So, that was a really interesting time, and that was all the while, sort of, you know, leading, managing a team of 45 comms specialists, you know, and deploying them all over the world, you know, whether it was on response force task group taskings, you know, deployed in different parts, you know, it could be within 2 to 5 days, depending on, the level. So a very interesting time.
Yeah, it sounds like it. I was just thinking while you were talking about how sort of military careers and that training and that mindset kind of lends itself really nicely to the world of sales. And
yeah,
I suppose, you know, there are so many, there's no right or wrong way to sell or to approach that, but certainly the military perspective is a kind of, in my opinion, a no-nonsense kind of straightforward, straight talking or straight shooting, like however you want to put it, without all the kind of fluff around it that certain approaches advocate. I don't know, what do you think about that?
Yeah. So, for the Royal Marines in particular, that they've got this framework. It's called the Commando Mindset, and it's a really powerful model, which, you know, applies to businesses, and it's what I use now. But just to give you an example, I think, you know, the Royal Marines, this was certainly when I was in, but the Royal Marines, you know, they only contribute 4% of sort of the UK number of military personnel. So only 4%. But what they contribute to special forces, UK special forces, is I think up to 43 or 46% of the UK special forces come from the Royal Marines. So, you know, they must be doing something right. And I think a lot of it is down to their commando mindset. And this model, this framework, is all about sort of understanding a situation, adapting to it, responding, okay, and then overcoming that challenge. And that applies to, you know, myself in what I do as in sales. So to apply to my situation, you know, we were a fairly new company. We weren't a large company. I think I was the sort of second employee. We have that fight, myself and the MD, as to who was the first employee. But, you know, we were targeting maritime. We were trying to sell SaaS products. And I was sort of based near Aberdeen, and we were targeting, you know, shipping companies. And that was a tough gig. And as you sort of begin to understand the situation, you know, the environment, you then, you know, sort of look at adapting and trying to find a way that you can, you know, make sense. You can make progression, you know, you can add value. And so I then responded, and this was a company-wide response, but we slightly changed tack, whereby instead of providing, you know, these SaaS products, what we realized was that these companies within maritime or energy, they weren't quite ready for the products yet. They were still at like 0.1 step of their security posture, you know, their pathway journey. And so, you know, it wasn't going to work trying to sell SaaS products within the OT space, the operational technology space. So we slightly amended it. And so we started providing those services first, okay, consultancy, whether that was, you know, asset registers, asset discovery, you know, vulnerability discovery, gap analysis. And we took that client on a journey until such time they were mature enough to receive the products. But, you know, by the time you get to that, you know, you've built that trust up, you know, that rapport. And it's a much better model, I think. So, you know, that was sort of adapting and then responding and then overcoming the challenge. And if you look at our company now, you know, we are up to 15 people, you know, sort of fluctuating between, you know, different, you know, contractors and so on. But, you know, we are very much established in energy, and that's my main focus is energy. But, you know, there's opportunities elsewhere, whether that's maritime, manufacturing, and defense. So, you know, a very exciting time. But that commando mindset, just to sort of bring it back, was really powerful in finding a way to achieve something in what was absolutely, you know, a new environment for me. You know, no network, you know, no actual established head office in Aberdeen targeting energy. And that was using that mindset, that framework, I was able to, alongside the team, and I had fantastic support, but, you know, come up with value, come up with real value and make a difference. And that's what we're doing now.
Yeah, it certainly sounds like you've been able to carve or capture a piece of the market there that maybe is a little bit more niche. And certainly I can see that there is that entrepreneurial spirit in you. And that kind of, you know, probably from that leadership background where it's coming from. But maybe just for the less knowledgeable listeners like myself,
yeah.
can you go into a little bit more about sort of the difference between like IT security and operational technology security? You know, I've heard of it before, you know, lots of books and things like that, but kind of, you know, what is it from... In your words, where is it heading? You mentioned that you know, it's that critical infrastructure in maritime, in energy, in healthcare, and so on. But maybe just kind of
paint the picture.
Teach us about that a little bit.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So you know, everyone knows about IT cybersecurity and the whole OT security. You know, it's been around. Don't get me wrong, but it's less understood. And so I will explain what it is in a bit, but you know, the less understood bit is, you know, a classic issue is about OT governance. You know, who is responsible for OT? And at the moment, there's a lot of companies that haven't defined that responsibility. You know, is it the CISO or is it the lead engineer? You know, is it the head of health and safety, you know, HSC, and technical insurance. And there's a real sort of lack of understanding as to who's responsible for OT. So what is OT? In my simplistic explanation, and there's a lot better explanations, but my simplistic sort of understanding is that OT is any sort of technology that interfaces with the physical world. Okay, so that can include industrial control systems, ICS systems, you know, SCADA systems, so supervisory control and data acquisition, and then DCS, so distributed control systems. You can fine tune even more so. So if you think of heating, ventilation, air conditioning, lighting, that's all, you know, considered OT. You know, if you think of a finance building, a high-rise finance building, you know, and you've got the lift system, you know, going up and down, you know, that's OT. You know, if that OT was attacked with a ransomware attack, that the building was, that could cause disruption, okay, and that could obviously make someone's day very uncomfortable. If you look at a car, it could be an ECU unit, so an electronic control unit within a car, or it could be as large as what you'd find in the national grid, you know, the national electricity grid. And, you know, you only have to look back at sort of, you know, why this is a big deal is that if you look at the Ukrainian situation there, you know, their Ukrainian power grid was attacked by, a nation state, and that crippled it back in, I think, 2015 and 2016. You look at more recent examples of what happened at the Colonial Pipeline. You know, that happened in IT, but it had a indirect consequence or a second order effect on the OT refueling. In South Africa, Transnet, you know, their unloading systems were taken down, and so they couldn't unload the maritime shipping, you know, and what is one of the busiest ports there in Africa. So, you know, the second order effect is, you know, you've got this maritime shipping coming in with all these, you know, these goods, and they're having to be redirected to another maritime port, to unload the goods. And of course that you start losing confidence, you know, and there's uncertainty. And so it is a big deal.
And would you say that the threat actors are growing? Are there more incidents than there used to be? And, you know, which is it, mainly like the energy sector that's being targeted, like those critical infrastructures?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So from what we've seen, and you get different reports, and I try and take a snapshot of various reports and then sort of build that picture up. But, you know, if you look at the last sort of 12 months, there's been a real focus on energy. Okay, so there was a report by Rockwell Automation that came out, I think, towards the back end of last year or beginning of this year, that energy was the main focus. You know, 39% of all attacks was focused on energy. And the next in line after that was manufacturing. I think it was 11%, and then transport, 10%. Which, you know, absolutely helps, myself out in terms of targeting and supporting energy companies protect against those attacks. But if you look at OT in terms of the operational effect, you know, the same report mentioned that it was, I think, 60% of OT incidents analyzed resulted in an operational disruption. So 60% result in operational disruption. And that's a big deal there. Another report from Aon Insurance, again, very recent, said that the impact of a cybersecurity incident, okay, can reduce shareholder value by 9% the following year. Okay, so you've got 60% of a operational disruption to a, you know, big energy company, you know, operating in the North Sea, and the impact on shareholder value is that it's been, the value is reduced by 9%. So, you know, you know, that can resonate, I think, with most people, whether you're an engineer or whether you're on the board. You know, those figures and the breadth of those examples and analysis from different reports is obviously quite clear that, you know, companies have to do better to protect against OT cyber attacks.
Yeah, it's a kind of that cascading chain reaction of events. You know, you've got that downtime, you're losing money, you've got that shareholder impact or the company's bottom line, you're losing money. It's kind of, you know, when all the Royal Mail stuff came out and Fujitsu's share price tanked, they lost billions sort of overnight just because of that ITV documentary. But so what would you say is the main kind of key driver for OT security at the moment? You know, because you mentioned earlier that kind of who's responsible for it, but you know what, unless somebody's telling you to do something, you can kind of go, well, nothing's happened yet, but are there checks and balances in place? Is there a compliance requirement? What's the driver there?
I think, you know, for OT in certain sectors, regulatory compliance is a big deal, and I think in fairness that probably makes most of those companies within that sector operating most nervous. So for example, you know, I mentioned maritime before, you know, they've got IMO guidelines, International Maritime Organization guidelines, and they're guidelines, you know, that they're not really enforceable. I know that, you know, maritime vessels, they should have a vessel cybersecurity officer nominated. They should have a cybersecurity management system and so on. But what they haven't got is the regulators, the auditors from, say, the Health and Safety Executive, HSE, coming on board and obviously checking their systems, auditing their systems. And if you look at what you find in energy, for example, you've got HSE and the regulators coming in and checking to ensure that these companies, you know, these operators of essential services, which are applicable to sort of NIS regulations, are securing their networks and systems. Okay, and so they have you know, operational guidance, but these auditors that will come in will check these companies, and if they're not actually following suit and complying with these you know, best practices like 62443, even 27001, but within an OG86 framework, you know, that's a big deal. That's a really big deal for an energy company. And, you know, a non-compliant organization, you know, can be fined up to 17 million if you're, you know, operator of essential service. And that could be nuclear, transport, utilities. But within Health and Safety Executive, you know, you can have your license withdrawn or terminated, you know, your license to operate. And again, that's a big deal for energy companies, for example. So what we see is a key driver is, yes, the protecting against OT attacks, but, you know, the regulation, the compliance regulatory part is really driving these companies to improve their security posture. And I think it's a good thing. I really do. I think it's a very good thing in that we're sort of moving with the times. We're getting better. And we're probably broadening our sort of corporate sort of understanding, knowledge in protecting our entities, you know, our organizations from these threats. And that can only be a good thing.
Yeah, I completely agree. Where does that put an organization or a solution like a Cyber Prism? I mean, obviously, you know, these compliances come into place. Because, like, same for Lapide, you know, cybersecurity solutions aren't revenue generating. It's always kind of convincing the board. It's like, well, this is a spend. What's the return on investment here? Well, is that 4% that you're going to have to pay of your annual revenue to the ICO were you to have a breach? You know, it's kind of like having insurance, right? But how does Cyber Prism, you know, where does it fit into that picture? Do you cover?
So again, you know, sort of harking back to that commando mindset of understanding and then adapting, responding. I mentioned, you know, we were a product-based company. We still are, okay, but we sort of realized quickly that they weren't ready for it yet. You know, they were still trying to work out what their OT sort of asset environment was and what OT assets they had in their register. You know, of course, if you don't know what you got, you can't protect it. So it was understanding that there was a service required, a consultancy service, you know, so providing OT cyber risk assessments, you know, technical authority to help, you know, these clients get a grip of their OT security. But the part with that, the consultancy services, you know, over time, it can be quite expensive. Okay, and that could be an issue for a client, you know, depending on what sector you are. So, you know, the client doesn't want to just rely on consultancy services. So we've come up with, a fairly unique way of creating a pathway whereby we have a service called OT Security as a Service, OT SecAS. And what we do is we provide that initial consultancy first, until such point we can pivot, okay, to OT security as a service, and then we bring in digital solutions, okay, to help the client, and so automating things, you know, compliance tracking, you know, but bringing in digital solutions so that you aren't reliant on the consultancy services. And what you have is you have like this upward curve whereby you've got consultancy services, it's following a line. And then what you want is you want this sort of tailing off where the security, the products, the automation, and the digital solutions come more into effect. And that reduces the price from consultancy and you more automate you know the solutions and thereby actually helping the client. Okay. So We think that's quite a novel way. We think that's a very good way of supporting companies. And it's all about a progression, a digital advancement, but actually getting the best digital products to help that particular client, okay? Rather than just relying on consultancy services and having a very sort of direct but maybe expensive way of doing things.
Yeah, it's an interesting go-to-market, certainly. You know, whenever we see competitors or like yourself, you're doing the risk assessment first on a kind of consultancy basis. It's something that, you know, maybe identifying those gaps that the client or the organization didn't know that they had, but then it's kind of a case of, well, now they can't unsee that. So action has to be taken, whether that be, you know, getting more consultation or bringing in some products to fill those gaps. But yeah, I think you've hit on that key word that a lot of CISOs you know, just float around these days, which is that automation piece.
Yeah.
You know, you want something that kind of does the heavy lifting for you. Obviously, you need to configure it to your use case in the beginning, but then kind of set it and forget it approach is preferred. Yeah.
I mean, so to give you an example, if you look at cyber incident response, okay, you know, that's fairly understood in IT. And, you know, there's an incident, you know, you're bringing in the CISO, you're bringing in, you know, maybe the CIO, the sort of IT department, HR. And it can get contained and, you know, there's a challenge in that, but it's not as complicated as what you'd find with OT, you know, cyber incident. So an OT, it could be vast, the number of people that are part of your response team in dealing with that incident. So you can think of like, you know, engineers, legal, HR, you're bringing in the IT department, you're bringing in the engineering department. It could be a company that has operational assets, you know, all over the world. You know, could be working off the coast of Africa, in Australasia, and the North Sea. And so, how do you make that OT cyber incident quicker, more efficient? Okay, and so you can automate it. And so, what we're doing is we've actually teamed up with a great company called Everbridge. They do critical event management, okay, mass notification. So think of a bushfire in Australia. You know, they can send a message out, a signal, a Teams call, and get the right people together at the right time at the right place. Okay, but what we're doing is with them, we are doing it for OT, an OT cyber incident response, okay, and we're automating it. And so that hasn't been done, you know, and I haven't come across anything yet that will automate OT cyber incident response. And that's just one example where a digital solution is there that, you know, that we have that we can then make the consultancy part, the services part, obviously less expensive, by relying on these amazing digital solutions to almost quicken the process and make it more efficient, and actually it's a lot more cost effective than having these expensive consultants on a retainer waiting around waiting to deal with an incident. So just another way of how digital solutions can really help the client and add value.
Got you, yeah. And I feel like you've really just given us a glimpse into the future of, you know, gaps in the market that you've identified and that you're filling with, you know, these new innovations as well. But, on a kind of final note, where do you see the future of Cyber Prism heading, or for yourself, perhaps, you know, yeah, your entrepreneurial aspirations?
Oh yeah, well, I do have those aspirations, but I have to say I'm really enjoying my time with Cyber Prism. You know, we've got a great team, and you know, OT security is still in its infancy, I think. I think there's so much to do yet. Every day, you know, sort of learn something new. There's new people to meet. It's a really exciting place to be. And sort of, I've got no intentions of leaving just yet. This is exactly where I want to be. But I think from a broader perspective, I think, you know, I mentioned, compliance, regulatory compliance. I think it's a matter of time before those same regimes, compliance regimes, start taking effect more so in, you know, manufacturing, for example, maritime. And I think, you know, we will pivot more, I think, once we see those opportunities, and there are there, but maybe focus more so on manufacturing and other sectors, because I think you know that those operators of essential services, those sectors operating within that, they are quickly understanding the importance of it, whereby some of the other sectors that aren't, you know, are not compelled to follow those regulations. There's no driving force behind it. You know, that I think that's a question of when it will happen, not an if. And so that's also pretty exciting for us. So certainly for me, manufacturing, you know, transport. I think that those are very interesting sectors that I'd love to focus on next. But it's all very good, and I'm absolutely enjoying my time. So no aspirations to leave just yet.
No, I wasn't getting at that, but certainly you've it sounds like you've got an eye for those gaps in the market. So yeah, there's always opportunities there. But it certainly sounds like it's that there is still a lot of room to grow for companies like Cyber Prism in the IT space. It does sound like one of those kind of doomsday battlefields where It's no longer the typical like warfare, but the cyber warfare that nation states are waging against each other. You see it, obviously fantasized in Hollywood movies, but it's all, I'm sure it's always going on sort of behind the scenes. We just don't hear about it.
Oh, I agree. Yeah, and that's one of the issues is the sort of understanding and so what really helps me is these companies. And I know there's commercial and confidence and issues there, and so they don't quite like revealing it. But the more we understand the problems at hand, the issues and the risks, it helps everyone else almost. So I'm all for information sharing and building up that knowledge and understanding. It's having that sort of that confidence to share the information so everyone together can sort of improve security within IT but OT as well. But that we're not there yet. But that's something that I think as we progress and you look at NIS2 directive, the reporting requirements for that is becoming more stringent. That will follow suit with NIS regulations. And so I think naturally, give it a year from now, 2 years, maybe 5 years, I think information, understanding what risks there are and how that maybe impacted one company from the next, I think we will have a greater understanding. And that will only benefit society as a whole, I think.
Yeah, it's kind
But
of
by,
making
at
it
the
more
moment, it's
standardized
been.
across the board, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly that. So, things are absolutely progressing in the right direction. And that's good to see.
Fantastic. Well, that's a positive note to end on in that case.
Right.
Awesome. Thank you very much, Dane. It was a pleasure.